I've known Håkan Hardenberger for a great many years, and it has been amazing to see what he has accomplished with his life. Almost single-handedly, he has been responsible for raising the level of the trumpet to that of a solo instrument, not only through his playing, but also through his commissioning of major contemporary composers. In part one of our conversation, Håkan talks about his three main teachers, Bo Nielsen, Pierre Thibault, and Tom Stevens, and what he learned from them. Håkan Hardenberger, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Tony. Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you on. And there's a lot of stuff I'd like to talk to you about. And first, I'd like to talk about your three teachers, the three main teachers, and some of the ideas that you got from them and how that has stayed with you for all of your life. And your first teacher was a good friend of mine, too, but really close to you, and that was Bo Nielsen. And before I ask you to talk about him, for people who hear this interview, if you go on Håkan's website, and Håkan, you tell me if you agree with this or not, and go to the photo section, there are eight photos, and the third photo, when I look at that photo, I see Bo Nielsen in you. I don't know if you've noticed that before or not, but it's touching to me.
Yeah, no, I don't see any physical resemblance between the two of us, I have to say. But, I mean, of course we are our teachers. That's how they stay on in us. It's how our parents stay on in us. We you know, I had a very good friend, a poet, Jacques Verhoop, and he said, you know, we laugh their laughters and we say their words, and that's how they stay alive. And it's definitely so with teachers, you know, although they tell us we should only keep 40% of what they say and throw the rest away, I think a lot remains and a lot filters through the years. And some things takes a very long time to assimilate. And some things you can do immediately as soon as you grasp it. Some things will take a week. Some things will take couple of years. And I had so many things. I mean, now I'm already moving to Thibault, but things that I knew, I understood, but it took me years to make them real. And then you have things that even surfaces again or a lot later.
It's almost like it's in your subconscious in a way. And things that happen during a lesson, you sort of get it, but then it's sort of gone. But years later, it's there.
Absolutely. Even you know, their bad habits.
Huh, okay.
Is something one should not neglect, you know, the bad habits of your teachers, because they will also surface, of course.
Wow, I've never thought about that. Okay.
And that's something also to work on, you know, because they will have had their hang-ups around the trumpet, and as we all have. And whether you want or not, you also put that onto your students.
Yeah.
And it's, I find that very interesting. I mean, I recently, the other day, I you know, I record these Charlier etudes, and a student of mine was playing one, and I said, wait a minute. And then as I said it, I realized that he was right, and I have been wrong all along. And it was one of the early ones, and I've been making the same mistake for about 45 years or so. and neither Bo nor Thibault said anything. And I've just played it like that. And I, in a way, I mean, of course, it irritates me no end, but at the same time, I find it rather touching that you also emulate the mistakes, the little, and you know, if we become very philosophical, it's in the imperfection that true beauty lies. Don't we think that?
Yeah, I think that's true. That is true. Yeah. It's funny. I was talking to Justin Bland. He's a Baroque trumpet player now living in Copenhagen, and he was talking about certain pieces that are written. Like for example, Bach would write, if he had something with bass and trumpet, he'd write. When he was talking about the devil, he'd write a lot of Fs, which were really bad notes, you know, and Justin even said, it's almost missing the point now when you do the Rite of Spring And the bassoon plays so beautifully at the beginning.
Yes.
Because back then, maybe they couldn't.
No, exactly.
Or probably they couldn't. And it sounded much more forced.
Yeah.
That said, I've never really thought of that concept, that not only the good, but maybe a few imperfections from each teacher stays with
yeah,
us.
Yeah, I think it's a touching thought. And you take it, and then you also see what they struggled with. But I mean, what would have been really interesting would have been to talk to them and ask them why they did what they did, why they did it in the sequence that they did, and how, from what I can remember, how I felt about it. But that would have been interesting because, frankly, all the exercises are there. We don't need to write another exercise for the trumpet. Yeah. You know, we have all the tools necessary, and we just need to use them at the right time and use our ears and our ideas to know what tool to use.
Did you ever have, I'll get to Boo in just a second, but did you ever find that you had like contrasting ideas from Boo or Pierre Thibault or Tom Stevens, where you had to figure out which way am I going to go with this, like in terms of the approach to music? Or, and I want to ask something about that in regards to your Charlier project in a couple of minutes, but just in terms of either approach to the trumpet or musicality?
I think I was always critical to information. Maybe that has something to do with my upbringing. My father was someone who liked to discuss everything. And of course, I mean, I guess with Boo, I was so young, you know, and I was eight, and we started immediately with lessons that were like 1.5 hours.
Wow. And how did your father pick Boo?
It was, I would say, pure coincidence. I mean, there was no music in my family of any, there was, you know, records to dance to, basically. I think the only trumpet records were James Last, you know, uh-huh. Something like that. But they bought a trumpet, and they bought a real trumpet, even if it was not a very good one. And then they asked in the music shop who could possibly teach. And they said, oh, well, there's this young trumpet player in the symphony orchestra. He teaches. And they phoned him. And I remember very vividly the first lesson, even. You know, he'd take me to this little place there and a little studio where the musicians of the orchestra used as practice rooms. And there was a piano, and he tried my ears a little bit. He played little intervals on the piano and saw if I could, you know, sing them more. And then immediately we started. And already first and second lessons were like 1.5 hours and not the usual 20 minutes, because I just loved it. I completely loved it. And that had a lot to say about his seriousness. You know, there was this 8-year-old kid that he took completely serious. I mean, you know him very well. He wouldn't,
yeah, sure.
You know, he wouldn't do any baby talk and you know, I mean, yeah. It was absolutely to the point and as if I was a grown up, basically.
But I'm sure he could tell from you, here's a kid who's really engaged and really wants to do it right from the beginning.
Yeah, probably. I mean, that's what we would have had to ask him. I mean, there was once they made a documentary film about me in Britain a long time ago, and he was interviewed. Okay. He was interviewed for that, and I remember he said a funny thing there. He said, "I'll try to imitate." I mean, I already have a Swedish accent. I'll try to imitate his Swedish accent.
Yeah.
So he said, "I just could kick him harder."
That's great. Okay. He used to, for the non-Swedes here, the southern part of Sweden, the sort of dialect is called Skåne.
That's what I have.
Yeah. And Boo did that so incredibly well. It was so funny to do. But, yeah. You know, I remember that we talked about the Malcolm Gladwell book and Outliers, and about the concept of the 10,000 hour rule, about to get really good at something, you have to practice 10,000 hours. What we didn't discuss is another main factor of that book, or tenet of that book, which was luck. And if you think that your father went to this music store, and what if your father said, well, take from this guy who's plays in a municipal band or something like that, what might have happened?
Well, I don't think, I think luck has very little to do with it. I think intuition is much stronger than luck. I remember around the time where I'd been given a trumpet for Christmas, you know, and no lesson had been taken or anything like that. Around that time, there was like a little publicity leaflet appeared at my parents, and it was in the next village, and there were some people there giving lessons. And, you know, so there was a telephone number they could call. And so my dad called them and said, oh, I hear you give trumpet lessons here. And then they said, yeah, does the boy own a trumpet? And then my father said, yes, and a very nice one too. And then they were suddenly not so interested any longer to give lessons.
Okay.
the whole purpose was to sell instruments from their shop. So, and also, you know, and then to find Bo and to find the you could call it luck, but I prefer intuition, and also that circles met and. I mean, I'm not going to get mystical about this, but it was very clear that it changed my life. I mean, that it was a trumpet and that it was Boo. You know, had it been a banjo and some guy, it wouldn't have changed my life the same way as it did.
Yeah, I think Boo changed my life too. I mean, I'm here in Europe because of Boo.
Well, he had a intensity about him.
Yes.
He would listen to any student forever and not give up and continue listening like a pit bull terrier who gets a grip and won't let go. And with a very, very warm heart. But mm-hmm. I remember a situation where I must have been maybe 9 or 10, and I'd played for a couple of years, where he suddenly said to my parents that you have to come every evening this week. Not for so long, but Håkan has to have a lesson every evening. So there must have been some sort of serious problem of which I can't remember at all what it was, but that was the typical thing for him. Then he would, you know, not let go.
Yeah. The interesting thing that I've noticed about his students is when I would be there for a day and I'd see him teach, is he would have one student come in and the student would be a terrific player, a really great player. And the next student would come in and could hardly play because they had so many embouchure problems. Mm-hmm. And so the range of ability, or let's say problem solving, with his students really varied quite a bit.
Sure. But I mean, when I first met him, he was 28 years old and had not so much experience in mm-hmm. in teaching. He wrote down, very much as I understood Schlossberg himself did, writing down the suitable exercise mm-hmm. for the week, like a doctor's prescription. And so he would write it down by hand, what I should do for the next week. And then eventually he would have me write it down. So I learned the tactility of and the connection between a written note on paper and that you play something, which I thought was very clever.
Yeah. What did he work with you on? How many years were you with him?
I was with Boo for 9 years.
Long time, okay.
And the beginning, I mean, if I look in that book, which I still have, it's very much based on Schlossberg. Mm-hmm. And then after that, Clark was really major. staple. And then he would work. I mean, he of course also traveled and studied. He was in Chicago, and I would then benefit from what he learned when he was traveling. And he met Thibaut as a student. But I would say Schlossberg Clark, and then moving on, Maggio, Louis Maggio.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Pedal notes and stuff like that. Before I then, myself met Jimmy Stamp when I was about 14, 15. Mm-hmm. And then we would work on that together. And then already the Charliers would come in and other stuff.
And so Boo suggested that you go then study with Thibaut, or was that your idea?
Well, the first meeting was Boo's idea. That's a funny story, actually, because we were going on just a family holiday trip for a week to Paris. So he said, "Well, you have to go and see this guy, Pierre Thibaut." Okay, we said, and we went to Paris, and then the poor travel agent in Paris, because Boo didn't think of giving us a phone number or anything like that. So we had to find also Pierre Thibaut. And there's about 6 million Pierre Thibaut in Paris, you know, if you look in the phone book. But by some miracle, this travel agent actually managed to find the right one. And I went and knocked on the door, and famous first phrase. I mean, I said, "Mr. Thibaut, I presume."
Okay, that's great.
And he invited me in, and I remember it was raining, and I had very, very wet shoes, and I was dying to take the shoes off, but he said he wanted to be polite. "Oh no, please keep your shoes on." strange thing to remember, but I remember also in the very first lesson with him, he made me play some stamp exercises. So all these circles have somehow always connected. So I was very young. I met Thibaut first time, and then it had been decided long time before that I was going to go to Chicago to study and become an orchestral player and all this. Mm-hmm. And then that meeting with Thibaut it clicked, and I then saw him in some summer courses with Stamp, and also in Montreux in the festival that was there, and I felt I want to study with him.
And it clicked because of his mentality or his intensity or the whole package.
Who knows? Why do people click? I mean, that's another book. And it just did. And of course, for my parents, sending a 16-year-old to Paris was already a tough thing to do. But to have sent a 16-year-old to Chicago might have been, you know, in the days before FaceTime and more easy ways to keep in touch. I think for them, Paris seemed like the easier way out.
Right, right. And you did not speak French when you went there?
No, I had a little Berlitz book, you know. I mean, I was 16, and in those days you did the entrance exam in the autumn, you know, sort of a weeks before its school started. So it was like a chance. I traveled down and I gave it a chance, and had it not worked, I would have gone home again.
Wow. And was that nerve-wracking for you, going to another country and not really knowing the language? Or did you just think, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, I don't remember that as being nerve-wracking, no. No. I mean, those things, you know, when you're 16, 17, you learn a language in 2 months.
Okay. You know, I remember you telling me this one story, and to me this seems so French, that you were taking, I don't know if it was a theory class or a solfège class, and you were really sick in the class. And the teacher said, go home and drink this specific, I think it was a Saint Emilion wine or something like that, and you'll get better. I think she sent you home and told you a wine to drink or something. Do I have that wrong?
It's much less glamorous than that.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yes.
First of all, I could never have afforded Saint Emilion wine.
Okay. Okay.
I don't know what background you come from, Tony, but
no, that's not my background either.
No, what it was, she was the solfège teacher, and she was Madame Giraudot de Basset, and she was wonderful. And she saw me struggling with, you know, I wasn't sleeping very well. It was a very cold place I was staying, and I was a bit sick. And she said, you have to eat horse meat. You have to eat stick tartare, so raw horse meat, because it has so much protein. And she gave me the money to go to the Boucherie Chevalinde, where they have horse meat, and buy. So that's what happened.
That's very French. Yeah. Well, the class you were in, it was a great class too.
Oh yeah, I mean, very much so. I mean, we there were many friends who've become great players, and It was a tough environment, but it was also, I think, intensity. If Bu was, I was used to intensity from him, mm-hmm. but this was another intensity. It was class was 3 days a week, and class would be an entire afternoon, and you'd sit there, and everybody was smoking except me, and and then when it was your turn, you'll cut your way through with a knife through the smoke and play. I remember first lesson in the class. I was seeing Thibaut all the time, but in the class, first time it was Arban Etude number one. So he said, it was my turn. So I got up and I played about two bars, and he said, too slow, sit down.
Okay.
And I was sure I would get another chance and play it faster. And no, that was it.
Until the next meeting.
Next week, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's good. You know, we have to do it when we have to do it.
Did you think you actually did play it fast enough and he just wanted it faster, or that you were playing it too slow?
I think I played it to the metronome mark of my edition, but maybe okay. That was the wrong edition. I don't know. And then there was someone who is unfortunately not with us anymore, Jean-Bernard Beauchamp. And we were the two young hotshots of the class. And Thibaut very cleverly saw that, oh, these two, I can use that. So if I got up first and play an etude, then he would always pick Jean-Bernard straight after me. And Jean-Bernard would, of course, play just a little bit faster than I did.
Okay, that's great. Okay.
And vice versa, you know.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, you know, there's one quote that I've heard you say about Thibaut, actually a couple of quotes, and one that I think is so great is, you set your own limits. I believe that's his quote.
Oh, very much so. I mean, or at least that's what he made me understand. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think in whatever thing you do in life, society and other people will try to put you in a box, in a limit. You know, this is what you do. This is what you're supposed to do. He made it clear to me that's not necessarily true. You know, I mean, and he was, you know, it sounds silly now when we talk, you know, an etude only being about speed and, you know, I really don't want him or people to get an image that he was all about, you know, the sporting aspects of the trumpet, because he definitely was not. It was all in a purpose to make music. He was not the most analytical about music, but very, very emotional about music. And he also gave me great, great freedom. You know, he he managed to. I mean, that's also something I would have liked to ask Boo, you know, how he took this little 8-year-old and did not make me sound just like a trumpet. I mean, what could be personality in the sound that I might have, I had early on. I mean, you heard me when I was pretty young. I think you, maybe you agree or not, I don't know, but that was there, and Boo didn't, he didn't try to change that. He didn't make it a conformity sound.
Yeah, for sure.
And then when I came to Thibaut also, he would very much respect certain aspects of what I was doing musically and not even touch them.
One of my other favorite quotes about from Thibaut is about starting the note and how a violin would start the note compared to a trumpet. You know, because that is the musical side, one of the musical sides of things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, are you wanting me to?
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
that's the lead-in line. Go for it.
I tell this in almost every class because
yeah, it's great though.
It is so. You know, because he was, of course, as a child, he was trained on the violin. He played the violin.
Right.
And his father wanted him to be a violinist, and but he would say, "Oh, yeah, on the violin there is 5,000 ways to play one note." And on the trumpet, we have two. We get it or we miss it.
Yeah.
And then he said, if you can have 10, and then starting, you know, at one extreme with, you know, no articulation, just air, and then have the other one, which is a very, very sharp, mm-hmm. the other extreme, then you have already the beginning of a language. And of course, the beginning of a sound creates the space for what that sound can be or not.
Right. Did he talk in terms of violin, like he would say, you know, violinists would play this up bow or down bow? Because it seems like a lot of brass players tend to play just down bow.
Yeah. We'll soon come to the next of my three wild teachers who maybe spoke more specifically of up and down, but Thibaut would say it would be more in imaginative words, but he would always refer to the violin a lot, mm-hmm. and he was also singing a lot in his teaching, and the way he would sing, you know, jim bim 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 bim, you know, this kind of he had a way of and of course also with solfège, singing wild phrases in solfège, you know, which teaches you that he hears what he's going to play, mm-hmm. you know, which should be taken for granted as a precondition, but we certainly don't always,
yeah.
you know. Now he wouldn't talk up, but he would make me play also violin things. He would. I remember him giving me the Paganini Capricci, and just practice them with no other goal than that, than to see, you know, what could I do, and then insist on the sort of intonation perfection or something that you would have on the violin. He said, "What's the reason? Why should we not have intonation on the trumpet? And why could we not have linear intonation sometimes?" You know, we are taught always that intonation is something vertical, because we play in chords with colleagues in the orchestra or in the ensemble. So intonation is always, you know, keep the third down or blah blah blah. You know, but linear intonation, where you know, an F sharp in G major is something completely different to an F sharp in D major, and depending also where about in the line of music it is, if it's suggesting the next chord or if it's remembering the chord that was just before. And this is something string players work with all the time, I mean, you hear a violinist like Ivry Gitlis, who just passed away. It's unbelievable linear intonation.
One note leading to another.
Yes.
Because like you mentioned an F sharp in G major, I mean, that's basically the third or the fifth.
Yes.
Of D major. And so a brass player in an orchestra is going to play that low, but
yes.
In the linear form, you're leading into the G, so you would play it higher, I guess, if you're a violin player.
As an example. I mean, yeah. not as a rule, but as a...
Right, yeah. Right. So, well, okay, so then after, how long were you with Thibaut?
So I was 3 years in the class, and I finished in 81 and was then 20 years old.
Okay, and then did you go back to Sweden and then immediately to Los Angeles? Or
yeah, well, in those days in Sweden, we had to do... military service. It was.
Oh, okay.
If you didn't do military service, you could not go back home. Basically, I would have had to stay in Paris, and they just started this new possibility of a military band, and they were doing first auditions. And my father said, "Well, wouldn't it be nice if you could?" So it was kind of my father who said, "Well, come home and do military service, and then you can, you know, come and visit us or live in Sweden if you want," and all that.
Yeah.
So I did that, and that was, in a way, in a year. But I'd already done some international competitions, and things were then kind of slowly starting. But I knew that I mean, first of all, I was still trying to simulate all the things I had learned in Paris. There were so many things I knew that I should be able to do, but that I couldn't do.
In terms of music or in terms of technical things or?
Both. Mm-hmm. I wasn't strong enough. I was building. I knew I was still very much in a process of building and building from foundation up. And I knew if I would start working in an orchestra, I wouldn't have time to do it. So that was one of the reasons. And then I knew that there was something missing. And I had met Tom Stevens also in sort of summer courses. And I was always intrigued. I mean, it hadn't been longer periods at all. And I was intrigued by his control of the instrument. Because I had, from Boo, I had certainly very, very solid foundation sound-wise. And I was using air well, and, you know, there was not... And with Thibaut, I acquired a certain wildness, let's say. And I was, in my playing, when I was doing, for instance, the competitions or the very few concerts I did. I certainly went for it. I mean, I didn't hold back, I was quite nervous, also, and I was longing for something that was control, and I was wondering whether Tom was, you know, maybe he was doing yoga or maybe there was some secret Californian mushroom he was eating. Or,
okay.
I had no idea what it was, you know, even if I had met him short. And you knew him. He was someone who would, when you talk to him, even when I was young, he would put more questions to your head than give answers. And mm-hmm. So I was longing to see what that was. And then it wasn't definitely no Californian mushrooms and also no yoga and nothing hocus pocus whatsoever. It was absolute text, reading the text and everything out of the text. And he would speak about what would this be on the violin? Would it be down bow or would it be up? And is that a... feminine cadence, is it, what is it? What is it in the music? You have to see it. And he had all his tricks and transposing sexy etudes. And,
I remember that.
I'm sure you do.
I remember you stamping on the floor when you, I think it was number 38 in E.
Yeah.
There was not a favorite. God.
Yeah. And then he would have you prepare, you know, play it in that key, and then he would change the key and then, but then insist on the phrasing. So I mean, I always say that's another cliche, but I always say that he taught me how to read music properly.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I studied with him, I don't think he ever told me what to do physically at all. It was just a musical concept. And there was one time where he said, play that low G louder. And I said, but how? And he said, I don't care if you have to stand on your head and piss on the wall, just do it.
Yeah. And also, you know, I mean, there was a piece that he played, he had recorded, and I loved it so much, the Henderson variation.
Oh, movements. Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
And so the first thing I wanted to do when I came to see him was, you know, I want to play the Henderson variation movements. Uh-huh. I never got to play the Henderson variation movements. Right? Uh-huh. And I don't think we ever touched one single piece of not the Henze, not the Berry, or not any of, you know, because that's not what he wanted to tell me. You know, he told me how to, if I can read the music, then I will make my mind up how I want that music to sound. You know, it's so much more, I wish I was clever like that teaching. He was so, so clever as a teacher. I mean, another thing he did, I was playing at the time when I came to him a Bach 1.5C mouthpiece. And he said, there was something in my sound. He liked my sound, but he wanted to add a little something. So he said, well, could you please try this mouthpiece for now? And I did, and I really liked it. I can't remember what it was, because 3 days later he took it away.
Okay.
And I said, oh, please. And then he gave me a second one, and he said, now play this. And I liked this as much. And to my astonishment, he took that one away as well. And then he gave me a mouthpiece that I didn't play for 35 years.
Whoa. And was that one even better than the first two?
Yeah, of course. And it was his intention from the beginning that that's the one I would. He was not guessing, but he, mm-hmm. because he took me through the other two, I didn't have the usual backlash. You know, you have a mouthpiece, a new mouthpiece. Oh, feels great. And then 2 days later, it's right. You know.
Boy, he knew his stuff. An incredible player, too. Yeah. I mean, I still think about him almost every day. You know, the things that I learned from him and just his personality. Such a strong personality.
Yeah, you know, in Chosen Vale, when we did these courses in his later years, and he played very little, but, you know, suddenly he would take the trumpet up and play. I mean, I remember one particular instance where he just took the trumpet and played the Leonora call, and that amazing, you know, focused, fantastically dark, dark but reverberant sound, you know, and it's just amazing.
Yeah. For me, I mean, as great as his recordings are, hearing him in person, taking a lesson from him and being right next to his bell was just amazing. That he had a really dark sound and yet it was really brilliant. And normally those two don't go together. If anything, a dark is dull and brilliant is bright.
Yeah, no, it certainly had, it was resonance, you know, it was all resonance. And I think that's the most difficult thing nowadays. You know, people have such possibilities to hear things online and we have every information is accessible with a click of a button. But the luxury of having heard those people next to you or in a concert hall is, I mean, I remember hearing Maurice Murphy playing Mahler 6, and I was sitting far back in the Salzburg Festspiel Hall, which is a very dull sounding hall, And his trumpet sound came like a glowing bullet straight into my belly. You know, I mean, very physical sensation that you can't. I mean, even if people sound great on record or whatever, that it's not the same. The life experience still beats absolutely everything.
In part two of our conversation, I ask Håkan about his recent project of recording the Charlier Etudes, his conducting, and his friendship with the conductor Andris Nelsons.